Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Cornell Veterinary Podcast, where we do a deep dive into the discovery, care, and learning that happens at Cornell University's College of Veterinary Medicine. I'm your fun and, might I add, fresh from a haircut host, Dr. Michelle Moyle, visiting clinical professor and general practitioner. And our guest today is Dr. Paul Mazza. I'm going to read this because there's a paragraph, because like you've done like a few things in your life. So it's not just like, you know, you eat burgers and you teach at Cornell. So I'm going to read this and keep my act together. Dr. Paul Mazza is an associate professor of practice in the Department of Biomedical Sciences. He received his veterinary degree at Ross University School of Veterinary Medicine and his PhD at Syracuse University. We love a double doctor here. I call you all the double D's. So at Cornell, he teaches courses in anatomy and physiology. He also leads veterinary clinic trips locally and around the world with the nonprofit group FARVETS, which we will get into because I'm very excited about this. This group helps underserved communities with sterilization, let's say spaying and neutering for those of you who might not use sterilization in the normal lingo, and wellness clinics for pets, super important. You have won multiple awards for your teaching and community outreach, and I'm very excited to have you here. Welcome to the show, Dr. Mazza.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Just FYI, I do eat a lot of burgers.
Okay, let it be known. Wait, do you have a favorite place in Ithaca for those I'm trying to draw in to come to Ithaca? Do you have a favorite burger place in Ithaca?
Oh, yeah, there are several. There's the Ale House, of course, the whole big bunch of burgers down there. So that's a fun place to go to. Red's is also good. Simeon's across the street from Red's has a good burger. There's the Antlers, and there's the place called Brewers. So there's a lot of places specializing in burgers, but a lot of places that have, you know, burgers on their menu for a bunch of other stuff. Apparently, you know, Ithaca, I've read, per capita has one of the highest number of restaurants.
What?
Nationwide. So it's
really?
Yeah, that's what I read. It depends what we qualify as restaurant. Of course, there's takeout places, there's sit-down places. But yeah, I read one time that there was, per capita, one of the highest number of restaurants.
That's amazing. Well, we've got to support our students, right, with lots of taste, and then we have to support our faculty. I'm going to disappoint a lot of listeners by telling them, or maybe I'll thrill a lot of listeners by letting them know I'm a vegetarian. Shout out to Glenwood Pines, who also supports with delicious burgers for the meat eaters, but also has a veggie burger for those like myself. So I appreciate that we just discussed that. What a way to start. This is great. We're going to jump right in because I think you do a lot of really cool things. And I would love to just know, like, can you just give us like a little summary of your path? Like, did you always want to be a veterinarian? Like, how did you get to here?
So like most of our veterinary students, of course, we're really interested in animals and people and science and medicine. I grew up really loving nature shows, wildlife shows, and I kept that passion and hobby all the way through college. And one of my original career goals was to study wild animal behavior in the field, especially large cats and wild dogs and their relatives. For practical purposes, you know, it was thinking about careers and jobs and being a professional in the field, and going to veterinary school was a natural kind of related career path. And in doing so, you know, I said, well, you know, I'll work on wild species, wild cats and wild dogs as a veterinarian. Practically, though, that we know that it's very difficult, you know, shout out to those that pursue those fields.
Incredible.
Very hard field to get into. And so for practical reasons, you know, went to private practice. My backup plan, I did get into a graduate program in animal behavior, and I was going to go there, but then I got into vet school, so I went to vet school instead.
Yeah, so your backup plan for becoming a doctor, that's really neat. Like, you have that ready. You're like, well, I'll just do this other, like, really also very cool thing. That's incredible.
My second backup plan was to be a zookeeper. I was a zookeeper assistant in college and had a great time doing that. And the zookeeper I worked with, she really wanted me to stay on, but I wanted to pursue some other stuff first.
Okay, now you're making me deviate from the plan, but I'm okay with this. Favorite animal at the zoo when you were a keeper?
Oh, so one of my jobs was to encourage the giraffes to cross over the walkway. They stayed in a barn on one side and their habitat was on the other, and they had to cross the Woodland Park Zoo in Seattle. And things have changed and, you know, things are much bigger and well-connected. But at that time, the giraffes had to cross a walkway, and it was my job to sit up on the little ridge and encourage them to come over with bread in my hand. So they'd come over and they'd wrap their tongues, their prehensile tongues around my hand and eat the bread. That was a fun experience.
Giraffe crossing guard. That's what I'm picturing. Like, bring it in. That's incredible.
That was fun.
That sounds like a lot of fun. I'm not going to jump into the worst because I think what a cool experience it was. And by worst, I mean like toughest animal it might have been to work with, because that's so neat that you got to work with giraffes. Oh my gosh. Okay. So we kind of know what sparked the career path, but how did you end up here teaching students?
So it's just kind of a happenstance. Coming out of vet school, one of my first jobs was teaching gross anatomy. It was a temporary job, and I had so much fun doing it. And I remember being with my classmates in school and such dedicated instructors. I was like, oh, this is fun. I could see myself doing this. And so having that one-year temporary job teaching anatomy sparked my interest in pursuing that. But I wanted to get clinical experience as well. So I went into clinical practice first and then ended up in Rochester, New York, all the while keeping my eye out for opportunities to work in an academic setting teaching veterinary students. And fortunately, you know, Rochester isn't too far from Ithaca. Some jobs opened up and I was able to come down and interview and eventually got the job that I have now.
Which is incredible. And this is not to age anyone, but you were there when I was a student. And so it's very exciting for me to talk to you in this capacity. I know we have a lot of amazing experts at Cornell and amazing clinicians, but there is, because I'm a general practitioner, there is a little bit something different that hits when a general practitioner or someone that has been doing it clinically teaches the anatomy, because you're like, this is what we see in practice. Like, pay attention to this. This plays a really important role. And we have incredible anatomists, and I've been taught by some as well. But there's just like, I really, really appreciated that as a student, just kind of knowing to pay attention to those little things, especially as someone who does a lot of surgery. So like, ooh, that's so neat. So we heard what, you know, kind of led you to become an instructor. And so this is neat because you're part of a curriculum that not every veterinary school teaches. And I want to make sure we highlight this because it was a big part of the reason why I went to Cornell for vet school. We call it PBL for short, but essentially it's called problem-based learning. And so I think it's a really unique experience for students. And can you share with the audience what the heck that means and why it might be great for some students?
Sure. Yeah. So problem-based learning has been the focus of the curriculum here at the Veterinary College 35 years or so, maybe 40. This is my 25th year, amazingly. And it's gone through a lot of changes, improvements, et cetera, to make it more efficient for learning. But basically, problem-based learning, as its name implies, we use a problem to help drive the learning. And what we mean by that is our problems are clinical cases. There is an issue with a patient, whether it's a dog with a breathing problem or a horse with a lameness. And we use that problem to help drive the learning. And like mentioned, we teach in an anatomy class. So the first semester of our students' vet school curriculum and career is in anatomy. And we have it's called the animal body. And our problem-based learning course is all based on things related to anatomy. And that's gross anatomy, microscopic anatomy, clinical anatomy, such as imaging and surgical anatomy, and developmental. All those topics are taken in consideration when we use this case to help drive our learning. For example, if we have a dog that had trouble breathing, we start to process the case. We're given a history of the case, and it starts out with small group discussions. We have our what we call tutor groups, and each tutor group has 7 or 8 students and a faculty facilitator that helps the students process the case. Yeah, you remember that. Yeah. And so, for example,
loved it.
That's right. We have, you know, a case and a dog comes in with a bit of a history, and we process the case by looking at what the facts are in that particular page of the case. What questions we might have, and the questions are important because the questions are, we're thinking as veterinarians, like we're asking the owners hypothetically, you know, what side did the dog get hit on, if there's trauma, or what do they mean by trouble breathing? Is it shallow, or is it deep? Is it labored? We can also ask questions of ourselves, like what structures are involved with trouble breathing? Is it the lungs? Is it the trachea? Is it the larynx? And then we can start to think about the anatomy of that, right? What is the pathway of air from the outside down to the lungs? What are the muscles of respiration? What does the gas exchange surface look like histologically? You know, how do we get innervation to and from the lungs? Things like that.
So down to microscopic, down to the nerve. So, and this is why it worked well for someone like me, because I learn really well in context.
That's right.
Right? So then when I'm like, oh gosh, I don't know, is it the lungs? Then we trace breathing through the mouth and the nose, right? Down the trachea, like you said. And then those are the things we're reviewing in anatomy. So like for me, it really was like an incredible experience and really great way to remember things. And you mentioned group, which is also really good, even though, listen, introverts, I know I could say this because I'm an extrovert and I like working in groups. And I know sometimes there's a feeling of dread when an introvert is like, don't tell me, Dr. Paul Mazza, double doctor, that we have to work in a small group of 8 to 10 people. But actually, it's really incredible for learning. The onus is not on you. You all share as a group. Right. So if someone read something and you're like, where did they get that? They would tell you and you would share. So there's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah. I myself am an introvert. And
sorry.
Yeah. It's hard to believe. But, you know, we took every year students, you know, do Myers-Briggs evaluations, et cetera. And sometimes I'll do it for fun. And, you know, I always come up as an introvert. You know, there's several letters, but the base of it is introvert. There was one year where the personality was matched to an animal. And my animal was a Labrador retriever. And so I'm not sure what that means.
Huh. I don't know if I would name them as an introvert.
Yeah, it's odd. You know, maybe, you know, there's, you know, energy and other types of things going on there. But in this curriculum, there's still a lot of room for all personalities, extroverts and introverts. And so when we do group study, yeah, there were extroverts that said, yeah, I really love this. I love working with others. And introverts, you know, they may thrive at working with one other person or by themselves, et cetera. But there's still a lot of ways for everyone to contribute to the discussion, whether or not it's leading a discussion or, you know, drawing on the board.
Drawing.
Or looking up in the dictionary terms, typing on the computer to keep notes. There's lots of things for everyone to do.
I love that. And introverts everywhere, I want you to know that I didn't say sorry to him because he's an introvert. I said sorry to him because he has to deal with me very much an extrovert, like 100% extrovert. We actually have a ton of introverts in veterinary medicine. And I think PBL is really great for that. Do you find that, how do students react to problem-based learning initially?
Yeah, that's one of the first things I ask students when they visit during their information sessions early and when we meet them for the first time during orientation. I ask them, you know, what do you think problem-based learning is and how do you think it'll work for you? And fortunately, most of the responses we get are, well, I chose Cornell, just like you did, Michelle. I chose Cornell for problem-based learning because they want to keep things in context. They want to learn where things are relevant and apply their knowledge. And they also happily will work in groups and in teams. But then there are others that aren't as enthusiastic and sometimes could struggle a little bit. So even though there are ones that are so super enthusiastic about joining the curriculum, there is a kind of a steep learning curve. Even though those that are extroverts may struggle a little bit, I think the reasons are threefold. You know, they're starting vet school, which is hard enough, right? They're moving to a new city, most of them, or maybe fourfold, starting a new type of teaching and learning. And then that teaching and learning is regarding all things anatomy, which isn't a prerequisite for most vet schools. So a lot of students may not have that kind of foundation coming in, which is fine. And we build that foundation and we increase it. But it's just another way for students to have a slightly difficult transition. However, you know, we quickly help them realize the benefits of problem-based learning. Like you said, relevance. We learn best by learning a topic that means something, and then we can apply it. For example, we learn the anatomy of physical exam, the rib spaces in which to listen for points of maximal intensity of a murmur, or the layers to do a thoracocentesis, et cetera.
Will you define thoracocentesis for some of our listeners?
Thoracocentesis means sticking a needle into the chest cavity in order to draw out fluid or air. That was the topic of our first problem-based learning case, a dog with air trapped in its what we call pleural cavity, but one of the cavities of the thorax outside the lungs, and it kind of compresses the lungs away from it. So a dog has trouble breathing.
Can't breathe.
And to relieve that, we'll stick a needle through the side of the bite wall, try to take that out. You may have seen that in, you know, medical shows and in movies and things. Yeah.
And I don't want to give too much away because I want, you know, if people are coming here, I want them to be immersed in it. But this is really cool because you're telling me they don't just stop at the lesson of the anatomy, which is what I was thrilled with. They keep going. So they learn about they see the x-rays associated with a dog with trouble breathing. They talk about thoracocentesis, which they're not even going to even think about until they're further along in school. So I still remember some of those cases. And this is what's really interesting. And I know I joke about context or I'll joke about cases, but still in practice, I'll be like, oh yeah, I know what that is. I'll never forget it. That was week one, right, of vet school. And what our students may not realize too is some of this, all of this actually runs concurrently with them. Just like you said, like when they're reviewing anatomy in the lab, they're also practicing listening to the lungs and the heart of live animals at the same time.
That's right. So there's this course called Block 7, which we call Animals, Veterinarians, Society. And we try to make the resources surrounding our problem-based learning curriculum relevant to what they're doing in their small group discussions. The small group discussions are the hub of the curriculum, the center point, where we do all their discussions and the students, with the help of their facilitators, try to figure out what they don't know, right? And so, oh, I don't know what the layers are for a thoracocentesis, or it's sticking a needle through the chest wall. So they'll make that a learning opportunity. They'll write it on the board, and then we'll discuss, well, where can we find out information for that? And this is one of the keys for problem-based learning, is teaching students how to find resources to solve the problem. And this is how it applies to veterinary medicine. There's so much information in veterinary medicine, we can't expect any veterinarian or any veterinary student to know it all, right? In four years or 8 years or whatever.
And new stuff comes out every day.
Yeah, new stuff every day. I was just reading about some new drugs just the other day in JAVMA, in the Journal of the AVMA. We can't expect anybody to remember all that. But what we can do is try to help instill a habit and a way for students to be resourceful to look up the information and find it efficiently and use it appropriately. That's what we try to do, which is one of the other main areas of difficulty transitioning is students coming from undergraduate curricula. You know, they're given notes, you know, they take notes, they might have notes taken by other people for them, they have slides, they're told to learn that material and take the test at the end of the week, right?
Right, kind of rote memorization, right? They just memorize it and they spit it back.
That's right. And so they do that and they take the test and they do well, of course, to get into veterinary school. But when they get to veterinary school, that technique may not work. But they do learn that learning to look up the information in an efficient way long-term helps with retention of that material. And then one thing that we should note is that students often think that when they come in, yeah, we have our group discussions and they look at the schedule and there's a lot of other activities. There's imaging lab and there's gross anatomy lab, histology lab, and it seems kind of haphazard, but we go through weeks and months of years of planning the curriculum such that their experience in their small group discussions is supported by these other activities. For example, like I mentioned, there's a concurrent course in physical exam. If in the case small group discussion, we're talking about doing a respiratory exam, they'll learn how to do a respiratory exam in the other course, Block 7, and we'll learn the muscles of respiration in Gross Lab, in the path of airways, in histology, et cetera. So all the other activities in the course go to support our students during their case discussions.
Having, you know, experience with the curriculum, I realized just how far in advance the amazing faculty are doing. I mean, sometimes years in advance, they're really working on shaping this. Now, I know this is a little bit of a love fest for PBL, and I want to keep moving on, but I know it's really tough, and I know I love the program, but it is a lot of volume, and I know that these students work hard, so I'm sure that they appreciate having somebody who's intimately involved with designing the curriculum that they're actually also teaching. So that's really awesome. Okay, but I'm going to switch topics because there's just so much. And I want to talk about your work with FARVETs. So it stands for Feral Abandoned Rescued Animals, Veterinarians, and or Field, right? Abroad, excuse me, I don't want to leave that out. Like abroad reaching out veterinarians. Oh, that's awesome. Okay, sorry. I'm so excited. I'm just reading from that. So this is a program or an organization, you're going to tell me more, that's been in operation since 2010. So can you just tell me how it got started and then just like let our audience know like what it is, what you do?
Sure. I'll start with what it is. We are a group.
Feel free to re-say, you know, you could repeat the title since I like was reading it.
No, you did just fine. So, you know, FARVETs, you know, there's an acronym that stands for Feral Abandoned Rescued Animal Veterinarians, because those are the population mostly that we work on. We do work on a lot of pet dogs and cats from communities. And then they also, the other acronym, you know, Field Abroad Reaching Out, goes along with a FAR. So the FARVETs, we go near and far to work in communities and help our animal welfare organization partners achieve their or address their missions and goals. And like you said, Michelle, it's regional. So we go as close as Auburn, just you know, a few miles away, down to Elmira. And then
the need is there no matter where, right? So the need is there local, the need is there far away.
And so how we got started was, it's kind of an interesting story. There is the anatomy teaching world, just like the veterinary world, is kind of small. So Dr. Evans, Howard Evans, well known love, one of his friends, Raymond Tarpley, at that time he was at Texas A&M, introduced me to him. And Dr. Tarpley asked me to introduce me again then to an animal welfare organization in Playa del Carmen, Mexico. This place was called Coco's Cat Rescue, run by Laura Rakes from the UK. And how I got introduced was that Raymond ran his own non-for-profit organization called MarVet, in which they do education programs for veterinary students in marine animal medicine, which is really cool. And some of our vet students have done that. So one of their programs is in Playa del Carmen, and they met Laura Rakes from Coco's Cat Rescue. She has just gotten started in the cat rescue and wanted some help with doing sterilizations of their cats. From my experience doing some similar work here, I said, yeah, we could probably do that. So I got a group of students together and we went down there. They had some veterinarians working with them also. So we all teamed up and we ran a clinic at Coco's Cat Rescue. And it was such a great experience for everyone that we kept going back just once a year to help Coco's Cat Rescue. Coco's Cat Rescue since has grown just dramatically. And they call themselves Coco's Animal Welfare now, because it's more than just a cat rescue. They do a lot of other things. So the first few years, we would take one trip a year, either spring break or the summertime, and we go down and run a clinic with Coco's Cat Rescue. So that was in 2010. So the first 3 years or so, we just did that. And then others in the area heard about our work there and said, hey, you know, maybe you can come down to our community in Puerto Morelos or in Chetumal, et cetera. And so we started communicating with them and traveled to those places as well. And since then, by word of mouth, we've gone all over the world, actually.
That's incredible. So two things that stand out. One, networking, even just talking to people and introducing people to other people can create amazing opportunities for animals and the people who love them and want to care for them, which is just outstanding. And two, wow, word of mouth is a big deal.
We do have a website and we do have a Facebook page, but to be honest, you know, they're a little bit outdated. There's only been a few times where we've reached out to others and say, hey, you know, would you like us to come work with you? People have heard us, like I said, through word of mouth, talking to others, and then have contacted us, and we try to communicate with them and see if we can work something out.
How many trips a year do you take on average?
The first couple of years was just one trip a year, and then it grew to like two trips a year. Before COVID, we had a couple of years we were doing four to six. Now it's about four to six again. There's one year we did as many as seven, I think, but now it's kind of settled down into four to six.
Wow, a settle down. In addition to your teaching, so because that's like not, you know, not that much. You're just hanging out. So what is a trip? I'm very much joking. This sounds like a lot. What does a trip entail? So like, how long does it last? So like, you get on the plane, you arrive where you're at.
Yeah. So I do have to fit these trips in amongst my teaching schedule. So that is the spring break, like I mentioned, winter break, and I do teach a summer class, so it has to be around the summer. Oh, I do. I should mention, though, that there is a pool of veterinarians, either alumni or ones that I've worked with or joined trips before, that have led teams and can lead teams in my place, so I don't have to do them all.
That's awesome.
Anymore, which is great, but I still, you know, do all the planning. It takes months of planning and organization. Maybe if it's a new location we're trying to communicate with, it takes up to a year of planning and communication. But once all that's done and we've prepped the students and we have all our supplies and we're on the plane and we land, we all try to either go as a group or at least meet at the airport where in the country that we're visiting at a specific time. And then we travel as a group to our local location. It's usually late at night. And we will do a brief prep, or we'll prep in the morning, just another last minute orientation in addition to all the planning we've done ahead of time and teaching the students. We'll set up in our location with our supplies, and the locations in where we go can vary. Sometimes, once in a while, we'll work with an animal welfare organization that is also an animal hospital. That's a luxury.
Wow,
But most of the time, our animal welfare organization partners are very much grassroots, small numbers of people in their organization. So, you know, we tell them, well, any place that is covered and has water and electricity at least nearby, we can work and set up. And so we've worked in town pavilions and in garages and lobbies of abandoned hotels and Buddhist monasteries now in Thailand. We work there. And in Guatemala, we work in the living room of our animal welfare organization host partners. So we ask them to, you know, get some tables set up, and they might have tables or just put pallets up on cinder blocks, et cetera. And hopefully there's lights. If they don't, we have our headlamps. So we need a place to do surgery, and we need some tables to set up the surgery equipment and anesthesia supplies and an area for the animals to recover. And once we have all that, then we're ready to work. And our host partners will do all the scheduling of the animals to come in each day and the order in which they're done. We'll just ask them, okay, who's first, who's next? Then our students will go out and meet the pet owners, if there are pet owners. Otherwise, you know, we'll go and examine as best we can the dogs and cats, and we'll introduce ourselves. Sometimes we have native speakers, like when we go to Guatemala, Honduras, et cetera, Bolivia. Yeah. Other times, you know, we have some rudimentary Spanish, like myself. And if not, then we can always use Google's Translate, which has been a big boom. When we went to Kyrgyzstan, we learned that, you know, you could just hold the phone up to a form or menu and it'll translate it for you. It was amazing. So, you know, we would tell them, you know, this is who we are. This is what we're going to do. If they have any questions, et cetera. And then we'll examine the dog or cat as best we can, making sure that, of course, the biggest thing is they're healthy enough to go under anesthesia for sterilization surgery, spay or neuter. And then we'll proceed. We'll give a sedation, insert catheters, and administer drugs to make them sleepy, and then prep them for surgery. And then the surgery is done by the team veterinarian, myself or one of the other veterinarians. We have at least one veterinarian on each team. In the early years, it was just me with veterinary students. And sometimes it still is just one veterinarian. Fortunately, those veterinarians are highly, highly experienced, and not just in surgery, but in this field work as well. And most of the times, we try to get more than one veterinarian and maybe even a licensed veterinary technician to come support the team as well. We'll do the procedures, and the students will get to prep the animals and monitor anesthesia, which is very important. And then other students will rotate through, and students will assist in surgery. So they'll learn how to pull tissues and gauze and instruments. And as the days go by, they'll start to learn surgical techniques as well, like tying sutures, ligatures, and instrument control, et cetera. So it's a great experience for all.
That's awesome. Even touching the tissue for the students, I think, is a really something they may not think about that's really important. For everybody listening, I really want to make sure that they understand. I think sometimes when we think about surgery, and you're the best person to talk about this, they're like, it has to be done in a very sterile room. Everything is we're, you know, head to toe covered. But we can do very clean, very safe surgery, even in a pavilion, right? Like you guys are using sterilized instruments, right? You're masked, you're capped, you're wearing gloves. So I want to make sure people understand that that's the case. This is not like you're just doing it haphazardly.
Yeah, that's a very good point to make, Michelle. And of course, in hospitals, the floor is clean enough to eat off of, et cetera. But in areas we go, there may not be any access to veterinary care in that town or maybe even in that
region. Or miles and miles,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
So the question is, well, what do we do then? You mean, do we do nothing? Because we can't have all the modern equipment. But there are, like I said, there are ways to make things very clean. We use masks and gloves, sterile gloves, of course. If we don't have access to autoclaves, which we often don't, we'll use a pressure cooker to sterilize. And there are resources that are out there that approved by, you know, many veterinary groups that are appropriate for conditions like this. You know, like I said, using a pressure cooker if there's no autoclave and similar habits.
That's neat. That just goes to show. So, you know, for everybody listening, many of you know, might know, an autoclave is used to kind of clean and sterilize instruments. It uses pressure and heat and all these settings somebody much smarter than me created. But here we are using something else in a non-traditional way, like something we use for food that can create a similar environment so we can make sure that our surgery is sterile. And I just think that that's outstanding. And so, okay, you've been doing this for a minute, like 15, almost 15 years, she says, rolling her eyes. Is there a memory that stands out to you? You are like, I will never forget that trip to Thailand. And let me tell you why. Like, is there one of those that you could share with us? Unless there was a lot of swearing, in which case you can pause.
There's probably one of those for every trip. But some of the things that do stick out, that we did a trip to Cambodia once, myself and one of my co-director, Dr. Jamie Lange. She's a Cornell graduate, 2017. So we went to Cambodia and did a clinic with a group called Animal Mama. And Animal Mama is run by a woman who worked with, I think it was the United Nations, doing child trafficking work, et cetera. And so this happens everywhere we go. There are some people that are just, they get into it for the animal welfare work. That's what they do. But most of our host partners are people that move to these countries or live in these countries, and they see the plight of their communities, dogs and cats. Then they said, well, we need to do something. And so this is one example. So she started this clinic, and she invited us to come down and to do a couple of things, to help run some sterilization clinics, some spay neuter clinics, and also to help instruct and teach some of their veterinarians. And that's a large part of what we do or try to do. In addition to running the sterilization clinics ourselves, we like to build some capacity and teach the community there, especially veterinarians there, how to do these things. And we're trying to do more of this to empower people to help their own communities. We taught them, you know, surgical techniques and other clinical procedures, et cetera. But what stood out was a couple of things. On one of the days we went down into the slums of Phnom Penh, and there's, you know, ramshackle houses, et cetera, everywhere. We set up a very impromptu clinic, and that was just eye-opening for the, you know, the types of areas we were in. And then in the same trip, we drove then from Phnom Penh to Angkor Wat, where, you know, the temples are, et cetera. And we ran a clinic there at a Buddhist temple. And what was significant about that was it was so popular that people kept bringing in dogs and cats for us to do. And, you know, of course, Cambodia, this is December, but Cambodia was still super hot. And it was myself, Jamie Landry, two veterinary students in their fourth year. So they were able to do some surgeries. Our Cambodian veterinarians, which their skills were still developing. We just kept on running the clinic. And, you know, when we look back, we did 2 days there, and each day we did, you know, 50 animals, which is a huge number for us. These aren't huge numbers for other groups that do similar work, but for us, it was very significant because our groups are small. At the end of the day, you know, our veterinary students were passed out on the floor in the temple because it was so hot and it was so hardworking. And then I just remember on the drive there and back, you know, we think that sometimes we have some really bad drivers in the States, and I'm sure we do. But traveling to some of these other places, sitting in the back of the van or the bus and watching them cross the line onto oncoming traffic just to pass the rickshaw or the tuk-tuk and narrowly missing getting hit head-on, that was eye-opening. And there's another place we went to. Sometimes Dr. Landry and I will go to a place to do some instruction or do a meet and greet in order to establish whether or not a location will be good for an entire group. And so we were invited to go to India, Delhi, and we went to the largest shelter in India, I think it was, is this Sanjay Gandhi Animal Care Center. It was memorable because it was just huge. It was on the outskirts of Delhi, but it was like its own walled city. It was 5 acres, all walled off, and within it were thousands of animals, dogs and cats, of course, but they had their emus, there were some goats, there were a lot of cattle just roaming around the streets, et cetera. And it was just, we think we have animal welfare issues here in the States, et cetera. There and in other countries, it's just mind-boggling. And due to, you know, overpopulation and lack of education of proper, responsible pet ownership, et cetera. So it was just amazing, the spectacle of all these animals in one location, even though it was 5 acres, it was jam-packed. We met a number of veterinarians there. They had a large number of veterinarians working at the animal care center, and we did some continuing education type stuff with them, but they were all very, very strong veterinarians. So we spent the rest of our time doing like an evaluation on the conditions at the shelter, hygiene and isolation and quarantine. We also, you know, worked on individual animals, et cetera. So that was pretty eye-opening as well.
I think what's neat about these trips, and I did some trips as students, not with FAR vets, but with other programs, is that when you go to these countries, you realize that people live in many different types of conditions. And they're still happy and they're still there with their pets and they live these lives and it's really different and it can make you appreciate what they have and it makes you appreciate what you have here in the US. And then again, the other thing I think I realized and I would talk to students about also is understanding that in some countries, spaying and neutering is actually like taboo. Like, why would we mess with an animal's normal anatomy? So it's a very interesting topic, right? Because, you know, you were saying here, we really value it as responsible pet ownership. We don't want overpopulation because we don't want these animals to be injured or sick or live their lives in cages. And there's just different types of thought. And you have to contend with that as you travel to all these countries. That's so neat. I'm going to ask you really like odd, I don't think it's an odd question, but in all these countries you've traveled to on all of these trips, I would like to know the favorite item you ate because I need to bring it back to food.
Wow. So
yeah, talk to me. Give it, tell us.
Oof, that's a hard one. So
I've stumped him.
India, of course, and a lot of spicy food.
Delicious.
And presentation was, it went to a couple of places. Presentation was very, very elegant. And, you know, we go to places and we try to eat a lot of local food, and we do, but as far as eating street food, I usually tell our group, well, let's wait until the last couple of days, right? In case that we have some issues.
As someone who's been ill traveling, yeah. That's a good
idea. So if you're not sick during when we need to do most of our work. I would say Thailand had some of the best food for two reasons. It's savory and it's plentiful and it's filling and it's delicious, but it's also very cheap. The first trip to Thailand we took, you know, we would just go from where we're staying just down the road, a couple blocks, get breakfast. And our host partners would provide breakfast, which was, you know, very gracious of them, you know, and but just to experience the local culture and food, we would also go down the block and go to the street market.
Yeah, second breakfast.
Yeah. Yeah.
Delicious.
We'll go to the street market and we'll get, you know, a bowl of a mixture of meat and rice and veggies off the cart for less than $1. And it was just amazing. Yeah. Sometimes when we go to places, if we get like an Airbnb or rent a house for the whole group to stay in one place, if there's a kitchen, we often try to make meals, even though it is not too expensive to eat in restaurants in those communities, and it helps those businesses. But we also like to go shopping at local markets, and we'll try to get food and make meals that are seemingly local, right? We'll try to mimic what was there. There's one trip we took to Bulgaria. You know, of course, everything was in Bulgarian. We didn't know what things were. We just kind of picked things that look good, cheeses and meats and veggies, etc. And our host partner there, her name was Gary, and she...
Was she like, no, we don't eat that normally. No.
Yeah, so she hosted us for dinner once, which was very nice, and a lunch. And then we would keep in touch with her through WhatsApp or video, et cetera. And we'd show her what we made. And she looked at it and said, what is that? Yeah, we don't eat that. And then the next day we tried to, there's one meal that she said, oh, that is just really bad for you. Just horrifically unhealthy. So the next day we went the other way and we tried to make, there's a lot of vegetables, a lot of cheeses, vegetables in Bulgaria to choose from. So we went to make a light lunch of cheeses and breads and veggies, et cetera. And then she looked at it and said, you guys are trying too hard.
Wow. You know what? I appreciate her straightforward attitude.
She was having a laugh at her expense, yeah, for sure.
So you've traveled to all these, there are a lot of different countries you've been to. You've been a veterinarian for a long time. You've been working with different doctors and lots of animals for a long time. Are there similarities across the board, like with animals and their people? Like we call it, you know, for people listening, we call it the human-animal bond, like that connection between animals and their people. Is there a similarity across the board around the world?
In one of the classes I teach here, I actually have a lecture on a human-animal bond. One of the things I mentioned is that we talked about is that no matter where we go, and we've experienced this firsthand through our Farvitz trips, no matter where we go, the geographic location, the human-animal bond is so strong in the communities that we visit, despite the socioeconomic status, the geographic location. So that's one thing that has been common and standard where we go. Of course, you know, the reason we go to these places is because, you know, there is an overall lack of access or maybe overall lower impression of dogs and cats in that area. But the people we meet and the people we help and the people who have dogs and cats, yeah, they may not be able to get them to their veterinarian either because they can't afford to or there is not a veterinarian in their town or in their region. They still love their dog or their cat as their family. We went to Colombia and ran a trip and people bring their dogs in wheelbarrows and take them home in wheelbarrows. And in Guatemala, a woman had a basket of cats on her head. And in Thailand, a woman drove up with a motorcycle and a sidecar full of cats. And then when they came to pick them up, they would be hugging their dogs and cats and so grateful for the care that's been given them and just relieved to have their family member back. So that is one thing that is very common in all these places that we go. The human-animal bond is very strong. I do have to say, though, that there are some differences. However, we go to many places where, everywhere we go, the people that we meet are animal welfare organization host partners and community members, their volunteers, and of course the people that have dogs and cats care for them deeply. There are some places, though, that there are some differences. Like some countries we go to, the dog and cat street population are of pests. And unfortunately, sometimes measures are taken that wouldn't be very tasteful for or allowable in other circumstances, like poisoning or shooting. That may happen. But then there are other places where animals are more tolerated and accepted. For example, you know, we went to Bolivia once, and the elevation in La Paz is like 13,000 feet, and it gets cold. Just walking around the streets, you glance down the street, you think you see, you know, like something down the road, and you think, oh, is it a small child with his puffy coat on? And you look further, and say, no, it's a dog wearing a coat. And people use, you know, spare clothes and blankets, and they put on their dogs, their own dogs, or maybe even stray dogs that they see to help them keep warm.
Yeah, cultural differences are cultural differences, and it's tough. And I like to travel, and sometimes it can be heartbreaking what's accepted, you know. And I was born, my parents aren't from the U.S., and they didn't have animals in the house. So that was a really interesting thing that I decided to become a veterinarian. Hi, Mom. Hi, Pop. So with our little bit of time left, because you are not just only a veterinarian, and I want people to understand that, you're not just a teacher. You are, in my opinion, you run a lot, and I'm struggling to understand why you do that. But what else do you do? So you're like a marathoner or an ultra runner? Talk to me. Talk to me about why you run, why you choose to run when someone is not chasing you, and maybe some other things you like to do when you're not in this space, because we're humans.
Yeah, so yeah, that's very interesting. So I mentioned my Fire Vets partner, Jamie Landry. So she and I run a lot together. And we were talking about this the other day. Why do we do these things? And the answer still eludes us and probably most of people that do ultramarathons. One thing I like to do it for is the adventure, right? These ultramarathons are often in...
How many miles?
Well, ultramarathon is anything above a traditional marathon. So 26.
So over 26 point.
Right. So officially, ultramarathon races start at 50K, so 31 miles. And the pinnacle used to be for trail ultramarathons, used to be 100 miler. But now we see and hear about runners, mountain runners and trail runners going for, you know, 150, 200, 250 mile events and races. It's just amazing. And so the adventure of it all and, you know, pushing your limits and seeing how far you can go and testing yourself. Of course, we wonder if it's healthy. Exercise is healthy, but is pushing yourself to these limits healthy? Not sure.
Right.
And
I appreciate that honest answer.
And then also just like the veterinary community, the trail running and ultra running community is kind of small and very tight-knit and very supportive of one another. And that's a nice thing to get into, too.
That's neat. I'm going to do a little quick thing. Favorite musical artist?
Oh, he's a musical artist. So when I'm running, sometimes I'll listen to things and have...
I mean, you have lots of time.
It's going through my head. Right now, it's Bob Marley. I'm listening to a lot of Bob Marley on my runs and et cetera. Yeah. Another one is from my college and high school days, and they're still active now. Punk group Social Distortion, they're good. It's a wide range of things.
Sometimes you need a lot of variety depending on the day.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Sometimes I listen to musicals.
When I love that.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Mary Poppins, you know?
Oh, good one. I was thinking about that the other day. TV shows at all that you would recommend to others?
I just got done watching a series called Warrior on Netflix. Yeah. And it's based on the writings of Bruce Lee. Interestingly, Bruce Lee was, of course, he was a kung fu martial artist, but he was more than that. You know, he's an athlete. He was a philosopher. He was a teacher. Yeah.
Yep.
And he was a pioneer in the realm of DEI, diversity,
equity and inclusion for all of you listening.
Yes. You know, back in the 60s when he came to the States, a lot of racial issues and diversity issues, and he had to deal with that. One of the main things was that teaching of Kung Fu back then was deemed to be only for Asians, only for Chinese, but he wanted to open up for everybody. He wanted to be more inclusive, et cetera. So he met a hardship a lot of that way. unfortunately, still being the victim or the subject of a lot of racial stereotypes, et cetera. Anyways, oh, you know what? Just claim to fame. My mom was friends with Bruce Lee back in the day.
Oh, yeah. That's a cool claim.
That's what I like to tell people. And so I just finished
Next
watching.
Next time we lead with that, not burgers.
Yeah, we should.
No offense. Just lead with who's famous. Okay.
So he, based on some of his writings, there is a show on Netflix called Warrior, in which a Chinese immigrant moved to San Francisco in the 1800s and tried to find his way in Chinatown and amongst issues of racism and poverty and things. It's fascinating. Very fun to watch. And of course, there's a lot of action in it too.
Well, awesome. Everyone, a nod to Warrior on Netflix. So many interesting things. Dr. Mazza, thank you for joining This Extrovert for the Cornell Veterinary Podcast. It was amazing talking to you. And I hope everyone enjoyed it as much as I did. And if everybody's listening and maybe watching, again, just a nod out, I just got my hair cut. So you can like the podcast, but you can also just click 5 stars because you like the host. That's also okay. Click it like and join us for our next episode of the Cornell Veterinary Podcast. Thank you so much, Dr. Mazza, and we will talk to you all soon.